This is Classic Business on Classic 1027 in Gauteng and Fine Music Radio in Cape Town.
Good evening and welcome back. It is time for the last portion of the show. My name is Peter Redlingeis, standing in for Michael Avery. Last portion of the show this evening is the roundtable or share shootout, where we are looking at a number of offshore stocks. We have a panel of three, I call them investment managers. This evening, the first one is Nader Tokan. I don't know if I'm saying your surname right, Nader. Portfolio manager at 27Four Investment Managers. Good evening and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. And you're saying my surname almost perfectly, like Token, like the stuff you put in the game.
Oh, right. Okay, I'm sorry. That's sometimes very challenging for me. The second guest we have this evening is Henry Biddlecombe, an investment analyst at Anchor Capital. Good evening, Henry. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Petrie. Good to be here.
All right, and the third on the line is Carolyn Kremen, who's actually in studio in Johannesburg, a portfolio manager at AdviceWorks. Good evening, and thank you for being here.
Hi, good evening, Petri.
All right, guys, so we have been through the ringer in South Africa, hey? Every second, everybody is saying, take your money out, take your money out, take your money out. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure if I disagree with them. I think the world is much bigger than just South Africa. We look at volumes through the JSE just absolutely tanking, for lack of a better word. I remember, you know, earlier in my earlier days of my trading career, volumes through the JSE were doing 32 to 36 billion rand a day. That's less than half at the moment on average. So investing offshore is definitely a hot topic. You guys each have got three individual picks that you have proposed for us this evening. I would like to start. We're going to go on a one-for-one basis, if that's all right. We're going to start with Nader to take us through his first stock pick for the evening. Could you tell us what it is and why you want to be invested in it?
Okay, so the first stock that I picked was Disney. I'm sure all the listeners and yourself are very aware with the company. Operates some theme parks and then predominantly a provider of some of the highest quality content in the world. So if you think of the Star Wars franchise, if you think of a lot of the animated movies, The Lion King, like a couple of the big blockbusters that have you know, come about and have had the largest debuts in history, in excess of $1 billion kind of on you know, in their opening months, is predominantly a lot of those franchises come out of the Disney stable, and they obviously get the purchase of 21st Century Fox very recently, so really consolidating their stronghold in terms of ownership of the content space. And then very topically recently, they obviously have the OTT or over-the-top content provider in the form of Hulu, where they owned a one-third stake, and their purchase of 21st Century Fox, what was the very nice part about it, was that they got the remaining two-thirds stake in Hulu, which is over-the-top content provider, basically direct competitor to the likes of Netflix globally. And they have their own streaming service called Disney Plus, where they're consolidating a lot of their content as well. So that's basically an overview of the business. And then they've actually got the theme park business, where, you know, they operate theme parks globally, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, in Europe, in Asia, through Hong Kong, busy, you know, setting up one in China, and then obviously the big attractions, the ones in the U.S., where they spent an inordinate amount of capital in terms of those theme parks. So those are basically the major business segments that Disney operates. The reason we like this business, you know, there's obviously been much frenzy around Netflix and about the fact that people are changing their consumption patterns in terms of how they consume content. Typically, the old school business model of cable television is thought to be completely disrupted by over-the-top content producers globally. That argument obviously holds more globally than it does in South Africa because of the access to high-speed internet. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that the bottom line here is that, you know, Disney is well placed to capture that audience for two reasons. One, they now own their own distributor in the form of Hulu and Disney Plus as well. And two, you know, and I think by far the guys who are going to be the biggest beneficiaries and winners of this race are going to be the guys who own the content, as opposed to the guys who are kind of purchasing the content on a license basis, and that license expires after a period of time. The reason I think that's the case is that the content is actually the stuff that matters, the stuff that providers are spending a lot of time and money on producing. If you look at Netflix, they're going to spend something like $13 billion over the course of the next 3 years, developing their own original content. So it is an exceptionally capital-intensive game. And the reality is that they're selling this on to consumers on the OTT, through the OTT channels, at very low margins. So if you look at somebody like Netflix, they're operating on something like an 8% operating margin. So obviously you don't have very high margins to sustain the significant amount of capital that you have to spend in the content space. So Disney already owns that content and have, increased their stronghold on that content through the purchase of 21st Century Fox. They obviously had to gear up the balance sheet a little bit to do that. That's a reality that time will tell in time. If they can deliver the growth in terms of warranting that, that debt can be easily swallowed. If you look at some of those numbers, the reality now is that Disney is now going to not provide their content to any of the other streaming services. They're basically going to choke them out completely on that. So all the animated content going to be on Disney Plus. The rest of their content going to be on the likes of Hulu. And if you think of their content, it's class-leading stuff. As we mentioned, the animated stuff as well as the Star Wars franchise, some of the largest blockbuster movies, the Marvel franchise, the superhero content, that's obviously massive globally. And basically, pretty much every movie they release is a blockbuster release, and each movie is surpassing the previous one in terms of net takings at the box office. That's basically now going to be only exclusively available through Disney platforms. And that gives them a major structural advantage over their competitors in terms of attracting clients onto their OTT platforms and basically then making them profitable. Given that it's a volume game, they're going to be able to attract the most significant amount of volume. So if we look at some of the stats of this company, they just reported results recently. Obviously, there's some issues around integration of the 21st Century Fox purchase that resulted in some increase in costs. There was the theme park slightly underperformed what the market was expecting, which, by the way, that's a very high-quality business. Given that it's so capital-intensive, the barriers to entry are high and there's not much competition there, so the margins are very healthy. But that disappointed slightly on the downside more recently. So we've seen the stock sell off a little bit after the release of the earnings, but that had to do with the fact that there's a global equity market sell-off as well. Ultimately, you're getting this business on a kind of around about a 15, 16-time forward multiple. So not as cheap as it once was. Remember, at one point, the market cap of Netflix was in excess of that of Disney. At that point, it was a screaming buy. I'd say that the easy money has now been made, but still a long-term structural growth operator within any global portfolio, and kind of a long-term, still a lot of structural growth left in that company, while still fairly high quality and hopefully be able to generate some healthy cash flow as they consolidate the volumes on their OTT platform.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. I see, Henry, you mentioned to me on Twitter, Henry on Stocks, if you're not following him, that you're also a fan of Disney, but you have some other stock picks this evening as well. Could you take us through your first one and make a bit of an investment case for it, please?
Yeah, sure. So we're big fans of Disney, but I think the previous commentator covered it well. So the next one for me is Facebook. That's a pretty controversial stock at this point in time.
Yes, it is. I'm not a fan of the business, but I'm a capitalist, so if I have to buy the stock for good reasons, I'll do that.
Well, let me give you a few. So if you've been looking at the charts of the PE, you'll see that this is a stock that's derated pretty significantly over the last while. And in fact, this is the cheapest that the stock's ever been. So if you the business has a market cap of around $520 billion, but it's sitting at about $42 billion in net cash. So if you subtract that cash from the market cap, you're paying less than 17 times forward earnings for the stock. Now, we think that the core business in its current state can grow earnings at around 20% per annum for the next 3 years. But what you're not pricing in is the optionality that exists across the platform in its integrated state. And what I mean by that is Facebook are busy with a very interesting and, in fact, a very extraordinary plan to integrate WhatsApp, Facebook, and Instagram. Which is going to create a sort of super social platform where it's not just about online advertising anymore, but in fact, businesses will be able to advertise and sell their merchandise directly on Instagram. Businesses will be able to interact with customers directly on WhatsApp instantaneously using asynchronous communication. And WhatsApp will also serve as a universal payments platform. And with the advent of the new Libra cryptocurrency, I think that this is a business that can double in value over the next 5 years.
I mean, it's okay. I've got my own views on what Libra is and how it kind of defeats the purpose of crypto. But there is a good case for it to be a tool for you know, commerce. If I could send somebody $10 on WhatsApp rather than having to do it with you know, traditional crypto or, you know, good old fashioned money, it is very convenient, and it is it is potentially a good you know, good opportunity for the likes of for Facebook.
For sure. I mean, think about the prospect of being able to send 10 Rand to your friend in Canada instantly and cost effectively. I mean, it's something that people just haven't been able to do before.
Okay, thank you very much. So we're going to move on quickly to Carolyn Kremen. Carolyn, of course, is a portfolio manager at AdviceWorks. Carolyn, the floor is yours.
Yeah, thank you. Look, I think we're positioning our portfolios now to prepare for a slowdown. So even if the U.S. is not going to go into recession, there's definitely a slowdown coming. And in this type of market, what you really want is you want companies that have got resilient cash flows, even in slow markets. And those cash flows should be translating into consistent dividends and dividends that can even grow in a slow market. So my absolute favorite at this point is a company called Brookfield Infrastructure Partners. Brookfield is one of the underlying subsidiaries of Brookfield Asset Management, which is really, it's a little bit like the Berkshire Hathaway of alternative investments. The infrastructure partners invest in things like utilities, transport, energy, infrastructure. You know, I always say to my clients, unlike South Africa, offshore utilities actually make money for their clients. And you know, it's one of those things that infrastructure projects tend not to stop in recessions if they've already been initiated. So it, you know, they go on, they keep on paying those distributions. It's on a very high dividend yield. It's on 4.5%. And one of the great attractions for that is because it's such a low yield environment offshore, you've seen institutional investors start to look around for yield. And infrastructure has actually become a very, very attractive asset class for them. So this also makes the stock very resilient from a price movement. They've got a huge amount of institutional investors, and institutional investors, pension funds, retirement funds, they're long-term investors, you know, so they don't panic and sell. So if you look at the share price reaction over the last months, you know, it's actually very stable compared to the rest of the market. They still have $3 billion on the balance sheet that they can deploy into various infrastructure projects. They've got a target of 12 to 15% return on investments. And the way it works is they don't necessarily buy an entire infrastructure project. They're going to joint ventures and partners with local partners, so that's all across the world. And those partners need to distribute all the cash flow, less amounts that they still require for capital investments, up into the partnership. So it's hugely cash generative and very, very defensive.
Okay, all right. And I mean, if we see a bit of, you know, we've tried monetary stimulus for the last 10 years and the interest rates are going negative all over the place, maybe the next step is a bit of fiscal stimulus. And I don't see how, you know, embarking on massive infrastructure projects is going to be bad for a company that basically builds infrastructure.
Yeah.
Right? So, all right, guys, we've got about 10 minutes left and we've got another couple of stocks to get through. So what we're going to do is we're going to go around again, and then we've got 3 minutes each, I think, and then we can give just a brief sort of overview of the last two remaining stock picks that you guys have. So starting with Nadir, your second and third stock pick for the evening, please.
Okay, so the second one is Google. Third one is Microsoft. We chat through Google quite quickly. Look, I mean, the bottom line is that people think that tech is extraordinarily expensive, especially within the U.S., because, you know, there's this perception in the market that that's what's driven all the returns. The bottom line is that this is a company which is growing earnings consistently at around 20% quarter in, quarter out, year in, year out, consistently growing earnings at 20%. The important thing about that 20% earnings growth is that it's filtering down into the cash flow statement as well, which is actually quite rare in the tech space to see strong cash flow generators. Facebook is maybe one of them. Google, Microsoft are the two others where you actually get robust cash flows, not just earnings growth. So the reality is that you're getting 20% earnings growth, you're getting it in a fairly certain environment, given that the Android software so well integrated and the cloud computing business is growing rapidly, and you're only paying around, 13 to 14 times forward earnings for Google. So this misnomer that tech is expensive, Google is actually not expensive and growing rapidly. Microsoft is still, as well, a very similar theme. The reality is that their cloud computing business is growing at north of 50% a year. It's growing very, very attractively, and basically what's allowed them to fund the cloud computing business is their old school software Microsoft Office business, which people actually underestimate. They think that it's a dying industry, declining volume growth, and ripe for structural disruption. That actually hasn't played out at all. It's still a phenomenal cash generator. The volume growth is not...
If I could interject for a second here, I switched to Mac as a primary computer a couple of years ago, and I tried and tried and tried to use the Mac Mail software. Over the weekend, I switched. I've been paying for Microsoft Office Online or whatever it is, $90 a month for years. Yeah. And for the first time, I switched back to Outlook in the last 3 years, and I feel like I'm a fool for not doing it sooner. It truly, I think they have a moat around that whole business. I think you're quite right.
Absolutely. And that moat is going to continue to exist, and the bottom line is the Office market all over the world uses it. So still phenomenally cash generative, and that's allowing them to kind of invest quite heavily into their cloud computing business, and that investment has so far been warranted. It's growing at a phenomenal rate. Again, almost in excess of a $1 trillion market cap at one point, it oscillates kind of between the top two or top three largest shares in the world. And there's a reason that it does that. It's actually fairly defensive growth. And defensive growth and certain growth in this environment, if people are willing to put a premium on. We're likely to see ongoing good performance from Microsoft as well.
Okay, thank you very much. And we shall, with that, move on to Henry. Stock pick number 2 and 3, if you please, sir.
So, Peter, you're an IT guy. Have you heard of Supermicro?
I think I may, but it rings a bell. Aren't they a microchip manufacturer?
Well, they're a hardware manufacturer that integrate microchips, yeah. So, I mean, they're one of the most successful IT hardware manufacturers in the world. But a lot of you probably haven't heard of them. And the reason being, most of their customers are, in fact, other businesses or other IT brands that use them as an OEM manufacturer. They've been highly successful because they're usually the first to market with a solution based on the new technologies coming out of the microprocessor manufacturers like AMD, Intel, and NVIDIA. And they're also able to custom manufacture, even in fairly low volumes, servers that cater towards very specific requirements. So they've gained a lot of favor with a lot of Fortune 100 companies that have interesting requirements, companies like Apple, Amazon, Google, and Facebook. But in 2018, a Bloomberg journalist released a fairly sensational piece claiming that these companies had been infiltrated by the Chinese government by implanting secret spy chips on the motherboards used by Supermicro. You remember the story?
Yeah. Now I remember the story.
And the share tanked almost overnight from $20 to $11.
Yeah, if I look at the price chart here, it was brutal.
And it's recovered. But of course, since then, the company's also grown its earnings. To cut a long story short, you're effectively paying 7 times forward earnings for what I think is a superb business. And over time, this is the sort of business that trades on a multiple of around 10 times. So as that earnings growth comes through, this business will continue to get cheaper and cheaper. And I think from here, there's a good 30 to 40% upside. So that's one I really like.
Okay.
The second one is Chegg, and that's probably a company that you haven't heard of. But
Never.
If you speak to any university student in the States, they would definitely have heard of it. And what these guys have done, I don't know if you remember in university, after the lecture, you'd be all confused with the new work that you'd have to cover, and you'd go upstairs to the tutor.
Yeah.
So they've effectively taken that process on.
I mean,
online.
Some of us went to the tutor, some of us might not.
Right. Right. Well, you were supposed to go to the tutor.
Yeah. I read it somewhere in the handbook. That's the process.
Jeez, I would have taken you for one of the tutors, Pietri. Clearly, I have you wrong, eh? So they've taken that process and put it online. And then they've managed to amass around 3 million subscribers. And they each pay between $15 and $30 per month for the privilege of having access to the material and their online tutors. And this is a market that I think amounts to around 55 million students globally. When you chat to management, they've got fairly realistic market penetration targets in mind. But when I do a DCF on the business, I get a fair value of between $55 and $65. And I would give this management team the benefit of the doubt when it comes to execution. So with the stock trading at $40, I really like it.
Okay. All right. We've got 3 minutes left, and we are over to Caroline Kremen.
Yeah, well, after that, I'm going to sound very, very boring. So,
Boring is good.
Someone has to be the defensive one on the panel this evening. Yeah.
So, again, going towards the potential slowdown, and I think one of the sectors that tends to be a little bit defensive in this is the healthcare sector. So my two stocks, both in that sector, the one is Johnson & Johnson, and the other one is Medtronic. Johnson & Johnson, I think most people are familiar with, 50% pharma, about 17% consumer. Medtronic, a lot of people might not have heard of. It's a medical devices company. Very, very balanced portfolio, focuses mainly on cardiothoracic medical devices, but also diabetes devices. And really, when you start to look at an aging population and healthcare expenditure increasing, both of these are beneficiaries of these. What I like about both of them is that they have sustainable cash flows, sustainable and growing dividends. You know, Medtronic's currently on a dividend yield of about 2%, Johnson & Johnson 2.9%. I think the one drawback for me with Medtronic at this point is it is a little bit expensive. So if the market does pull back, I think it is something very, very nice to pick up. Johnson & Johnson has actually lagged the S&P, and it's not so much to do with anything Donald Trump tweets. It's rather to do with the fact that they've actually recently been the subject of a kind of a wall of litigation about opioid abuse, the talc, the baby powder potentially being linked to ovarian cancer. They have made provisions for that, and they've got about $15 billion sitting on the balance sheet. So even though those lawsuits probably don't have an enormous amount of merit to them, they could absorb it if it actually would happen. And their dividend yield, I don't think, would be under threat.
Okay. All righty. Okay. Thank you very, very much, guys. I really appreciate it. Have you got anything else that you want to add, Caroline? You've got a couple more minutes to go.
I speak very fast.
Yeah.
Okay. So just
I want to give you a fair chance.
Yeah, and I actually just want to chat a little bit about the Johnson & Johnson lawsuits, because you know it is something that gets brought up a lot when you speak to clients about that. First of all, on the opioid side, Johnson & Johnson was actually one of the smaller providers of opioids into the U.S. market, and in fact, as the addiction crisis increased, their sales were actually decreasing. So it unfortunately does seem, you know, lawmakers and politicians tend to see a big company and see it as a cash cow. So, and I think it is either Oklahoma or Ohio, it's one of the O states, you know, they've recently instituted law. They're looking for $17 billion. And, you know, compared to the amount of opioids that were supplied into the market, it seems as if they're targeting Johnson & Johnson as opposed to some of the smaller pharmaceuticals. Players, because if they went after the guys who actually produced it, those companies would be technically bankrupt. So
Johnson & Johnson has the deep
has got the deep pockets.
It, right?
But the thing is, you know, when you have these outlandish lawsuits and settlements, 95% of the time, you know, a court will actually reduce it quite substantially. On the baby powder linked to ovarian cancer. You know, I think recently there's been a Department of Justice investigation to figure out how executives knew about this beforehand. Johnson & Johnson made very clear that there isn't, they don't feel there is any link between talcum powder and ovarian cancer. And in fact, the U.S. National Institute of Health has also come out and said there's no scientific evidence that the use of talc increases the risk of ovarian cancer. So now so for me, it just really looks like it's bad publicity. I don't think we're going to have another situation like Bayer, you know, where you had Roundup and there were credible links to increase cancer. So I think, you know, if you look at Johnson & Johnson, litigation is part of the medical industry, you know, where if you're a device producer or if you're a pharmaceutical producer, there's going to be litigation. You need to look past that and you need to look at the underlying business case.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much. And that, lady and gentlemen, is all we have time for this evening. So thank you very much for joining me. That was Caroline Kremen, portfolio manager at AdviceWorks. We had Henry Biddlecombe, investment analyst at Anchor Capital, and Nadir Token, portfolio manager at 27Four Investment Managers.